Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and my co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek, is spending quality time with his family, but don't worry, he'll be back with us in 2 weeks. Now, for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions, and sending in your comments, thank you so much. And please continue to spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to all those things that make us happier, healthier, and more successful in this constantly changing future. Now, Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. We will introduce you to talented authors and new innovations in the area of health, security, and fun for you and your family. Now, with over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of these areas of expertise. Now, our topic today is going to be interesting. The topic is risk-taking. And our guest, Kate Sukul, will be telling us quite a bit about that, as well as her new book. Now, Kate earned a Bachelor's of Science degree in Cognitive Psychology from Carnegie Mellon University, and a master's degree in engineering psychology from the Georgia Institute of Technology. Now, a passionate traveler and science writer, her work has appeared in Atlantic Monthly, New Scientist, USA Today, The Washington Post, Islands, Parenting Magazine, Bark, I don't know, that's not one I know about, American Baby, and the AARP Bulletin. Now, she is a partner in the award-winning family travel website, Travel Savvy Mom, and is also a frequent contributor to the Dana Foundation's many science publications. Now, much of her work can be found on her website, which is www.katesukul.com. And I'm going to spell that one for you. That's KAYTSUKEL.com. And it includes stories about out-of-body experiences, computer models of schizophrenia, exotic travel with young children, and so much more. And she is the author of This Is Your Brain on Sex, The Science Behind the Search for Love, and her newest book and the topic of our show, The Art of Risk, The New Science of Courage, Caution, and Chance. And she frequently shares on Twitter, so for those of you who would like to follow her, you can do so at Kate Sukul. So, Kate, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, I'm really interested in this subject, and in your new book, because for those that don't know, I mean, I'm also an investigator. So, with your new book, The Art of Risk, The New Science of Courage, Caution, and Chance, I noticed that it's been described as an investigation into the science of risk taking. So, obviously, right. As an investigator, you know, my first thought is, what motivated you to conduct an investigation into risk taking?
You know, For me, I'm trained in neuroscience, and it's a really fascinating new lens to look at some pretty existential human questions. You know, why do we love? Why do we make the decisions that we do? And of course, why do we take risks? A lot of us, you know, we talk to people and we know people in our lives that are risk takers. Some of them successful, that go out there and manage to achieve all their dreams and by throwing caution to the wind. And other people who take risks and don't fare so well. So I guess I kind of wanted to understand what risk-taking was. And then more personally, you know, I'd always been described as a risk-taker growing up, and certainly I had a really unconventional path. But I kind of hit 40 and moved back to the United States from Germany, you know, bought a house, got a station wagon. And all of a sudden, I did not feel so, you know, risk prone anymore. In fact, I felt the opposite, very risk averse. You know, I wasn't having a midlife crisis. I was having a midlife crisis in reverse. Instead of, you know, getting a Corvette and a boy toy, you know, I joined a PTO and started watching Law and Order marathons every weekend. So I really wanted to understand what risk taking was, why, how it sort of intersects with learning and success. And then I wanted to figure out how I could do it better.
Well, now share with us, I'm sure you've piqued some interest out there in regards to what were the things that led people to believe that you were a risk taker when you were young?
You know, you need my mother for that, who would probably have you on the phone for the next 4 hours, starting with, you know, things I did as a toddler. But, you know, I decided that I wanted to be a dancer, so I dropped out of high school early. And, you know, that wasn't my demise, as so many people said. I actually then got into Carnegie Mellon, you know, early and succeeded pretty well there. I did not start out as a writer. I started out as a usability engineer. And this is, writing is probably my third or fourth career. And, of course, writing is the thing that you're never supposed to, you know, be successful at. And yet I've managed to land, I don't know how successful I might be in, you know, compared to some people, but, you know, I landed 2 book deals, which surprises a lot of people. I was married to a soldier. I, you know, moved to Europe when he deployed to Iraq, and instead of doing a sensible thing and moving back to the States and, you know, sort of hanging out with family, I stayed in Europe, gave birth to a baby boy, and then decided to strap into my back and start exploring Africa, the Middle East, and, you know, Europe and Asia. Because when else was I going to get the chance, including some places that a lot of people felt were unsafe? So I guess, you know, to me, these things didn't seem so risky. They seemed like a natural progression of things. And I'm sure a lot of people who you consider risk takers would make the same argument. You know, but there's something that, there are things that brought me joy and, you know, managed to bring a lot of curiosity and wonder and also a lot of learning along the way.
Well, now that poses the question, during your investigation, did you come up with an answer to the question, are risk takers born or are they made?
I did, although it's not as simple and cut and dry as I had hoped. And in fact, it's funny, when I first started on this book, I really thought that there was something, you know, very different about risk takers, that there was something in their biological makeup that just made them view the world in a very different way than most people. Sort of in the, you know, the way there's a book called The Sports Gene that talks about, you know, all these wonderful genetic and biological ways that our sports heroes manage to excel the way that they do. You know, I thought there must be some kind of risk-taking gene out there. There must be something biologically that allows them to see opportunity where the rest of us just see danger. And it only took a couple of interviews to find out that that was not the case, because the book is not only an investigation into the science. You know, I kind of wanted some checks and balances. So I also interviewed some real-world risk takers, including, you know, one of my extreme sports heroes, you know, Steph Davis, who is a wingsuit flyer, base jumper, and free solo climber. I talked to a serial entrepreneur. I talked to a neurosurgeon, an Army Special Forces operator, a firefighter, lots of people that we consider to be, you know, sort of everyday risk takers, to talk to them about how they viewed it. And ironically, you know, when I'd go around to asking them about being risk takers, they'd all kind of give me some version of, oh, I'm not a risk taker. And you'd have to stop and be like, hi, you rush into burning buildings, or you jump off of cliffs wearing nothing but a wingsuit. How can you say you're not a risk taker? And then they'd sort of take a step back and say, okay, well, maybe some people would consider me a risk taker, but I don't. And that's because I don't take unnecessary risks. And
exactly.
So this is fascinating, you know, because I think for a lot of us, you know, we look at these things, we think that these people do the impossible, whether it's those extreme sports or whether it's, you know, brokering these million-dollar business deals, you know, or for some people, it's just a matter of, you know, flying internationally or traveling to you know, maybe, you know, not so safe places or what have you, not so developed places, I guess would be a better way to put it. But, you know, these people, they don't see it that way. And I thought that was really interesting, because it means that maybe risk-taking isn't a personality trait. It isn't something, you know, like the sports gene or the risk-taking gene. Maybe it's something that all of us have within our power to harness for our own success and for reaching our own long-term goals, whatever that may be.
Yeah, and I think you're right. And I think that, that we all measure it differently. And like the person you said that, you know, you ask them and they go, well, no, I don't see myself as that. And so to them, I think they've just measured it differently. An example in my case was there was a time in which I raced motorcycles in the desert. And people said, oh, my God, how can you take that risk? And I went, I'm prepared. I mean, it's what I do. I'm prepared. I'm on my own. And whatever happens, I've caused it. So to me, I'm not taking a risk. At the same time, I would tell them, I won't ride a motorcycle on the street. That's too risky. You know, and they look at me like, well, but everybody does that, and go, no, but you see, to me, with, you know, the way that I view it, it's differently than the way another person views it. In fact, a dear friend of mine has at the salutation line below his name, to where it says, you know, I am not a gambler. I just take great, but it says I'm not a gambler. I just take greater risks than most. And so which then brings us to the other point. What is the difference between a risk and a gamble?
Oh, well, I think it comes down to the key word that you just mentioned, which is preparation. Now, certainly when we talk about gambling, a lot of times it's, you know, we're talking about casino games. And certainly many of those are games of chance. You know, you can't tell how the die are going to come up or what have you. There's no way to prepare for, you know, a roulette wheel or a slot machine. But games like poker, blackjack, these are also games of skill. And when you have preparation, when you have experience, even though, you know, the odds are still in favor of the house, there's still a chance for you to move forward and potentially win. And how do you do that? By being able to read the other players, by being able to, you know, calculate out when on that 16, based on what, you know, the other cards you're seeing on the table, you should hit and when you should stay. It's when you're playing Texas Hold'em, really trying to calculate out, is that person bluffing or do they really have something? And those are actual skills. So time and time again, what you see with successful risk takers is that they are really thoughtful and prepared. And of course, we don't want to think about it that way, right? We don't want to have to do the homework and do the work. We just want to naturally be successful, and victorious. But what really makes the difference, you know, when Steph Davis is base jumping or free solo climbing, she puts a lot of work and effort into it. And while you may see this YouTube video of her climbing, you know, a 1,000-foot peak with no ropes, what you don't see is all the work that went into that beforehand. Mm-hmm. You don't see how she actually climbed it with ropes the first, four dozen times. You don't see how she's talked to everybody who's ever, you know, free soloed or even climbed that peak to get their idea of what the best route up is. You don't see her physical fitness, bouldering, running, getting in the physical shape she needs to be to get there. None of that is apparent in the video. All you see is her no ropes on the side of this cliff and start to hyperventilate. So it really does come down to preparation and doing your homework.
Yeah. Now, I just listened to a show that had Travis Pastrana on it. So for those that out there that don't know who that is, I mean, he's an extreme sports legend now, but he started in motorcycles. And one of the questions that was posed to him was, I think the first time he did like a double flip in the air or something like that. And he said, well, he says, what people didn't see is that I did that over 200 times into a foam pit before I ever attempted it. You know, so yes, I think you make a great point, is nobody sees those other things behind that is the preparation that allows them to be successful. So yeah, I agree.
And you take it outside of extreme sports. If you think about firefighters, police, Army Special Forces operators, you know, what do they have in spades training? They're doing things over and over and over again. They are, you know, basically practicing the worst case scenario, so that their skills are sharp and really they can fall back on habits and training to help carry them forward when, you know, the proverbial stuff hits the fan. And I think that's really important, because not only does that sort of practice, that preparation, it really sort of syncs up your body and mind with the world around you, But you know what to focus on and what not to. I think the rest of us, you know, using the Steph Davis example, I watch her climb and I start to hyperventilate a little. And I realize if I were on that same rock face, although I would tell you right now, I have a harness and ropes and maybe, you know, like a big net below me, you know, I'd be sitting there freaking out about, okay, wait, how do I get my hand into this crack? How do I pull myself up? I'd be focused on all these things that would actually distract me from getting to the top. And she is laser focused. She knows exactly what she needs to pay attention to, what not to pay attention to get to the top. And that is all thanks to that earlier preparation and all of that work that you never saw behind the scenes.
Yeah, and we have a message coming in. This is an email, and I think this sort of touches on maybe what some of the parents are going through if they have a child that is one of these people we're describing. This one reads, my two sons, 17 and 19, couldn't be more different. The 17-year-old is conservative to the degree that he takes no chances whatsoever. The other son, 19, is an adventure seeker who loves skydiving, extreme sports, paragliding, rock climbing, and so on. He scares the bejesus, is in quotes, out of me, as he can't seem to get enough of what he calls the rush. Mm-hmm. It says, would your book help me, the, and she has herself in parentheses again, Millie in the middle, address these extremes in personality, or maybe just deal with my own anxiety?
Yeah, I actually think it would. I think there are a couple of things that are going on here. And the first one is, you know, the teenage years, people call teenagers the ultimate risk takers for a lot of reasons. And basically, if you look at our neurobiology and just the way that our brains need to change so that we can develop into, you know, good, thoughtful adults, you're kind of primed for risk taking in this age range. Adolescence, even your more conservative bookwormy type is still going to go out there and explore more. And you know, it can be scary. You know, my kids are just on the cusp of, adolescence. And I will tell you, I already know that one of them is going to be that rush seeker and the other one's going to be more conservative and my hair is going to turn gray. But I think that, the one thing to keep in mind is that Mother Nature did not do this recklessly. She had something in mind, and that is that there needs to be this kind of risk-taking so that teens can get the experience they need to become successful adults. And that means they need all that motivation. They need that rush. They need to fall down, not just 7 times, get down 8, get up 8. They need to fall down 700 times and get up 800 just so they can figure out, you know, how as adults they're supposed to interact with the world. And in terms of extreme sports, you know, I think where you ask yourself what you think about, given that all of us are built like a little bit differently and we have different tolerances or different needs, you know, is your older child, the risk taker, you know, being safe within these things? Are they learning? Are they using appropriate safety, equipment? I think that there's a big difference between somebody who is, you know, I don't want to say going by the rules, but pursuing these kind of hobbies, but doing so safely with, you know, regulation, with scaffolding, with help and getting better at them, and somebody who is just flying by the seat of their pants. Because more and more, you know, psychologists and scientists are learning is that there is a big difference between what we would call impulsive behavior and risk-taking behavior. And I actually have to sort of give an example of my son when he was 2 for this impulsive behavior. Mm-hmm. We were in a cafe in Germany. He really wanted some chocolate cake. He hadn't eaten his dinner yet, so I said no. The lady next to me, and it's a small German cafe, so the tables are very close together, and there was this older woman sitting next to us at a table by herself, and she had just ordered herself a piece of chocolate cake. My 2-year-old hopped down from his chair after I told him no, put his hand in her cake, and shoved it in his mouth. Now, when you're a 2-year-old, this is kind of adorable, and we still tell this story because it's funny. But imagine if he had done that at 17. Or 36. All of a sudden, it was really impulsive. He wanted cake. He wanted it now. He didn't want to hear me saying, okay, not yet. We can talk about it after you finish your dinner. You know, that's impulsive. So if that son is going after the rush, you know, on impulse without thinking about making sure to, you know, go to the right places, have the right safety equipment, you know, work with the right people, that's when it becomes a concern. That's when it becomes a pathology. But in terms of seeking these things out, you know, they are, you know, so many more opportunities to experience more extreme sports and, you know, more activities like this. And when they're done the right way, they're actually quite safe. You're much more likely to die driving, you know, on the freeway than you are skydiving. But it's hard for people who are unfamiliar with skydiving to understand it.
Now, you mentioned in regards to the teenage brain and how in many cases it may need 700 times to try something and then fail. Have we gotten to a point to where we've become so incredibly protective to where we don't allow them to take enough risks? I think in many cases we've kind of shifted to this point to where, you know, they're in the house, they're playing video games, they're not out there, like, you know, and I look to myself and say, you know, riding my bike until the street lights turned off, and sometimes, you know, going down hills too fast and crashing and getting up and coming home with scraped knees and scraped elbows. Have we gone too far?
I absolutely think so. And, you know, I think helicopter parenting, what's kind of interesting about this is I think, you know, as people are studying it, we see that it's a very unique phenomenon to a certain social class, to certain areas of the country. You know, kids who grew up in a lot of big cities that don't necessarily have a lot of money, and kids who are growing up outside of suburbia, this doesn't seem to be as much of a concern. But kids, you know, what we fail to see with risk-taking is why it's so important is that it's necessary for learning and growth. And there are all kinds of movements now, the free-range kids movement, you know, all kinds of studies that show why it's so important for kids of all ages to learn how to fail, to learn how to make mistakes, to fall down. You can't, you know, wrap your kids in proverbial bubble wrap and then, you know, expect them to be able to interact with the world. You know, and it's funny, I went back to Georgia Tech just recently, and I was meeting with my old advisor, and he was telling me just how much it's changed, you know, how often now, even with grad students, their parents are calling him to say that they're stressing out, you know, their kids who are in their mid-20s about their, you know, thesis defense or what have you. Well, you know what? If you're going to succeed in academia, you're going to have to get through a thesis defense. You're going to have people pressing on your ideas and your theories, and you're going to have to take those things to make it better. And if you don't learn how to handle that kind of criticism pretty early on in life, you're probably not going to succeed. And it's the same way with anything, whether it's, you know, climbing trees or riding bikes or doing your schoolwork. You know, kids need to mess up. You know, giving them a soft place to land isn't necessarily a bad thing. You know, encouraging them to get up and try move forward again. But they need to understand what it's like to what I call fail forward. Mess up, make mistakes, and then pick themselves up, dust themselves off, and try all over again. We can't protect them from it if we really want them to grow up and, you know, be able to take care of themselves. And we want them to take care of themselves. We don't want them to live in our basements forever, no matter how much we think that might be kind of fun.
Yeah, exactly. And I've said the same thing to many parents that I've talked with. You're not going to be there forever. You have to allow them to go through this. Now, we're going to take a break. We're going to be right back. And again, we are talking with Kate Sukel. The subject is risk-taking. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. And we're back. I'm Alan Cardoza. You're listening to Answers for the Family. And our topic today is risk-taking. Our guest is Kate Sukel, and her book is The Art of Risk, The New Science of Courage, Caution, and Chance. Now, Kate, many of the people that listen to the show know that I do a lot of my research at the gym. So I'm pedaling while I'm doing some of my research. Oftentimes I have like a copy of your book sitting on, you know, in front of me. And the people around me that know this, because I've done this now for 8 years, I get people that walk up and talk about the show. Hey, I heard the show last week, and they'll comment about it, but they'll also say, so what's up for next week, or what's up for, you know, what's coming up? And in this particular case, where they started talking about risk, at the same time, the televisions were on up above us. And we know now that the biggest issue is our election that's going on at this time. Now, as the conversation, I started talking about risk-taking, and then people around me started talking about the election, and it sort of put the two things together. Share with us a little bit about the decisions that some of these candidates have made, and I'm not trying to make this political, but I'm just saying that they've made decisions that in some cases, as they've narrowed down the field, has either chosen to take a risk or they've chosen to not take a risk. Share with us a little bit about how you see that.
Well, I'm actually going to turn that a little bit around onto the voter, because I think this is the more interesting phenomenon. Because, you know, one of the things that I talk about in the book is how, you know, basically we'd like to think that we are optimal thinkers, that we are logical, that we are rational, that with the information we have, we're making the best possible decision, especially when it comes to a risky decision or an uncertain one. But here's the interesting thing about the election for me, is that we also know that when we're very emotional or we're very stressed out, that kind of throws a kink in the works. That, you know, we have a really sophisticated circuit that, you know, helps us sort of decide whether to take a risk or not to make that decision. And just having, you know, sort of heightened emotions really changes it. So the easy example for this is the lottery. And anytime the Powerball goes over 300 million, although I don't think I can even say 300 million anymore because it's been up to 500 million, you know, everybody buys a ticket. You know, almost everybody. People who know way better buy a ticket. And, you know, you can go onto the lottery website and you can see that winning the Powerball is like 1 in 298 million. That's the chance of it. And yet you start thinking about winning. What would you do with that money? You could go into work on Monday and tell your boss to shove it and buy your parents that house they always wanted and put your kids through college. And all of a sudden you're seeing yourself driving down the Pacific Coast Highway in a Lamborghini, you know, and all those good feelings all of a sudden turn that 1 in 298 million into some chance of winning.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with the election, this also works with negative emotions. So fear, anger, this also kind of throws a wrench in this calculation. And that's where I think some of the candidates have been really so successful. And, you know, I'm not trying to pick on, well, maybe I am trying to pick on Donald Trump a little bit. But, you know, he has really amassed a lot of fear and anger in people. And what that does is when they're listening to, you know, things that he's saying, talking about policies or what he's going to do, it doesn't matter anymore that he may not have the resources to actually do those things. You know, it's same with the lottery. Instead of that 1 in 298 million chance, there's some chance. So instead of, you know, actual facts and figures that back up his particular policies, it comes into some chance, whether that be targeting immigration, building a wall, bringing manufacturing industries back to towns where they've been gone, you know, for more than 20 years, it turns into some chance. So he's really channeling that anger and, you know, using that uncertainty against voters. So I think what's really important as a voter is you do your research, and not just on, you know, your favorite sort of biased site, read, thorough explanations of their policies, what they plan to do, what they can do. Mm-hmm. And, I think the other side of this is so much focus has been on the presidential election. We're not focusing on the fact that real change begins at home. So let's look at our local senators, our council members, our local judges. Who are the people that we want to actually shape policy and day-to-day life in our communities? And it's amazing to me how often you talk to voters and they're not paying attention to any of that. Because they're so, upset about what Hillary or Donald or whoever has done right now. So I think it's really, on the voter. So if I take it back to your question and ask about, the candidates and how they're doing things, from my perspective, I see Donald Trump doing a lot of gambling. Just in that he sort of says things off the cuff. He doesn't necessarily have the data to back it up. When he gets caught, he just says, well, I've heard other people saying that, which is not a good way to back it up. And I think that those are more gambles, and I'll be curious to see how well they work out for him. With Hillary Clinton, she's got, it's hard to know whether she addressed things head on, whether it would work in her favor or not. It seems like historically, when she has tried to address different issues, directly, it comes back to bite her. So in some ways, I think she's taking a very measured approach. But I could make the opposite argument as well.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a great point. And to kind of back up a little bit, one of the things you said that's maybe a little bit off the subject as far as the risk-taking, but when you said one of the key things is for people to do their homework, to investigate, as you said, the things that are possible or the things that are reasonable and not just at whatever website or newscast that you choose to listen to that might have a slant in one way or the other, but to go out and listen to a lot of things and do the research necessary instead of taking a soundbite that somebody passed on that has been changed over the time. So I think that's a great thing for people to understand. And then as you brought up about the risk of the people not only making their vote, but even choosing to talk about it, because I think that in many cases, and again, I had somebody that started a conversation with me, and they started it with an incredibly negative point towards one of the candidates. And then they stopped themselves and they looked at me and said, I hope that I didn't, offend you. I haven't talked to you in a long time, so I don't know where you stand. And so I think they thought that there was a risk in even choosing to talk about it at that point, which I think is dangerous. We can't get to a point to where we are choosing not to talk about things or choosing not to question things because we fear the reprisal, that risk becomes too much for us. Hello? You know what? I believe that we may have had some technical difficulty, or maybe it's just the fact that we ended up talking about politics. And as soon as politics came up, whoever it is that's controlling that out there may have cut us off. So we're going to get our guest back on the line. Again, I want to thank everybody for listening. And let me touch on a little bit in regards to what it is that we're trying to do. We are trying to increase our reach. We're trying to increase our census. So we are bringing on, I believe, just some really dynamic guests that are able to bring up things.
Hi,
that
it's 832-328-97.
And it may be that the reason that we did get cut off may have to do with maybe a loss of power with the phone if it's going straight to voicemail. But anyway, as I was saying, is that what we're focused on is really bringing as much really good content to all of you so that when you have the opportunity or you're talking about something, you can go to our archives. You can go to theanswersforthefamily.com and type in a subject. And now after over 400 shows, you can go in there.
Hi, 832-328.
Anyway, So, and I guess what I can say is that, so Kate, if you are listening, you don't need to try to call back in. Ronan will call you, our engineer. He will reach you and he will get you back on the line. If there's been a problem, I know you mentioned that you're having thunderstorms in your area when we first started this. If you're having problems with the landline, then it's possible that our engineer can call you on the cell. But just go ahead and remain calm. Wait for the call. He will get a hold of you.
832-328-9733.
And for some reason, it's going straight to your voicemail. So anyway, we have about 9 minutes in regards to the show. So let me go to one of the questions, and it may be something that actually that I can answer. One of the questions was, you know, I hope this is not too off the path, but I love the title of your book and ordered a copy last week. So this listener makes a comment that says, I look around and I feel such fear in people as if they want to bury their heads in the sand or more like into TV dramas and sitcoms rather than participate in life. They talk about real estate to the financial market crashes, all of these looming doom and gloom issues. They seem to be upset over politics, believing that it's just a sham. And that Mother Nature is starting to hammer us with disasters coast to coast. And like so many others, you know, I hate turning on the news, but we seem to be becoming a nation frozen and numb to the point that we can't risk getting out of our chairs and actually changing things. Now, this comes from Betty in Arizona. So, Betty, first of all, thank you so much for sharing this. And, Kate, if you are back with us, what is your comment to Betty?
Well, I think that, you know, there's risk to and risk from, right? I mean, the thing is that it may seem like it's overwhelming and we can't get out of our chairs and we can't do anything. And yet, what's the alternative? You know, there's a risk from getting out and trying to make a change. There's also risk from just hiding in your house in front of the television. And I think that what we do see, whether we are talking about these big, sweeping global phenomena, or if we're just talking about, you know, trying to get a promotion at work or, you know, make things better with our spouse or what have you, what we see is that big changes come in tiny little incremental steps. And I try to remember that, you know, not to get all philosophical with the, you know, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step, and yet it really is, I think, these little steps that take us forward, that allow us to learn and to make, you know, the kind of changes so that we don't feel so overwhelmed. There's a lot of power in small wins, but there are no small wins unless you take those small steps.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. If we can, you know, take a step back, focus on what it is that we can do specifically for our family, which doesn't mean to ignore what's going on out there, or as this listener says, you know, bury their head in the sand. No, I don't think that that is the answer at all. And I would agree that we don't want to be doing that. But that doesn't mean that you can't take those small victories from doing the things that you want to do with your family, on focusing on those things. And again, I love what Kate said, which had to do with, you know, what are the things that you can do right now, your local elections? Are you looking at who's going to be voted in as the next judge? Who's going to be voted in as the next, you know, your local congressperson? And it'll make a difference at that level. And it may be something that will seem more attainable to you, which also then allows you to feel better about what it is that you're doing. Kate, would you agree?
I would agree. You know, that all kind of circles back around to, you know, doing your homework, being prepared. And, you know, whether it's making a decision about who to vote for in this election, about focusing on, you know, your local community, or whether, you know, it's taking bigger steps in life or trying to, you know, approach global warming. And, you know, even if it's just managing a recycling program in your neighborhood, or, you know, these little things add up to a lot.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more that there are so many things that we can do, and you can do them with your family. You can do them with your kids. Recycling is a good example, to show them the things that can be done to make a small difference. But at the same time, realizing that if more parents are doing that same thing, those, 1 million small differences all of a sudden make a big difference.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So let me see here. We have another question that had come in. This one had to do with are we calculating bad risks? And again, this kind of goes into that national level, but somebody had called in regards to like the bathroom discrimination laws and such. Why is it that it seems, according to this person, that we are in trying to answer what they believe is a relatively small problem, and are we calculating and taking a much bigger risk by focusing on something like that?
Well, I would think that, again, this is an example where anger and fear have taken something and made it into something it's not. I live in Houston. Houston sort of started this whole bathroom mess. I think what's really interesting to me about a lot of this is probably every single one of us knows at least one transgender child or person and probably does not realize it. We have probably shared the bathroom with them and probably have not realized it. But here in Houston, this actually started with an anti-discrimination ordinance in the city of Houston. It had already been voted in. It had been in here a year with no problems whatsoever, absolutely nothing to do with bathrooms. It just put it in there saying that they were going to have to offer no discrimination, for public facilities like bathrooms. And somebody picked it up and turned it into this thing about predators coming into the little girl's room just because somebody decided that they were a woman that day. And just the fear and the anger over that it took on a life of its own. And I have friends who then voted to repeal that anti-discrimination ordinance here in Houston, and they didn't even understand what it was they were voting for. That fear, that, sort of campaign, just had twisted them up so much. They didn't even know what it was all about. They thought they were protecting their children from predators. They didn't realize they were voting down an anti-discrimination, ordinance. So, I think that's a really fascinating thing. And it just shows how, pushing on these right buttons and making people feel angry or sad or, scared is a big one, really just throws the whole calculation out of whack.
If we
look at the statistics, the thing is, there are already laws that stop people from going into the restrooms should help prevent, people going to restrooms to molest children. This isn't adding anything that isn't already there. But it is taking away, dignity and opportunity from a group of people. And I think, if people researched it and actually looked into it, as opposed to having that visceral, oh, I want to protect my daughters. And as a mom of a girl and a boy, I'm thinking, why don't you want to protect your sons, too? I think that if people looked deeper past that fear, they'd realize that this really is kind of a tempest in a teapot. And something that is just making people, dividing people over what basically amounts to a non-issue.
Well, and I think that goes to the point that you made before, which is educate oneself, gain the facts, gain the information necessary to make the decision. And maybe at that point, that also then goes to the point that we don't feel as though we're taking such a risk with our vote.
Right.
We're not taking a risk with it because we feel that we have educated ourselves and we have not let either side change that by providing information that is flaming emotion rather than focusing on the specifics of a particular measure or a particular vote that you're taking.
Mm-hmm. And I also, at this point, so much of this election is all about sound bites, and it's about hyping people up. And so, you know, although TV news is a very easy and digestible way of figuring, you know, knowing what's happening in the world, you know, newspapers, more thoughtful, in-depth analyses of what's actually going on, what these things mean, you know, as opposed to some newscaster having three pundits come on and ask about, you know, whether women are built for these kind of high-pressure jobs, or, you know, things that just automatically kind of get people worked up. I think it's more in your favor. It's going to the right sources, you know, and you can go to a variety of different sources. That, I know that everybody wants to throw this liberal media card down, but Wall Street Journal is not liberal. You know, the Washington Post is fairly valid. You know, the New York Times, reading a variety of sources to really get a fuller picture of a certain issue or happening, I think really is valuable. You know, you can't get a lot of in-depth information from a 24-second soundbite.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you can't get it from a headline. You know, the headline itself, if that's all you read, you know, you're going to be probably running around with some fear, thinking that, you know, that everything, because headlines are made just for that reason, to elicit an emotion, as opposed to really reading down into something and understanding that, yes, there are people that write, there are people that speak or whatever that may have a bias or a slant. But if you take in all the information, you're going to have a better chance of being able to think it through and make your own decision. And in hopes then also makes you less anxious and more confident in what it is that you're saying and what your vote is doing for us.
Exactly.
So, well, we're just about out of time, but tell us a little bit about what else it is that you're doing, and then I want to let people know how they can get a hold of you.
Sure. I work with a company called APG Speakers, and I go around and speak to different organizations about risk, and that could be tailored to finance, to parenting, to insurance, to all kinds of things, because risk really is something that touches on each and every decision we make and every aspect of our lives. So, of course, I would love for you to check out my website at katesukel.com, KAYTSUKEL. .com to figure out where I'd be and come out and say hi. Of course, you can find me Art of Risk wherever books are sold. It was named by Amazon as a best business and leadership book a couple months ago, which was great. But again, as I said, it's not just about business and leadership. I think it's something understanding how our brains default when it comes to uncertainty, what kind of shortcuts it likes to take, I think is really valuable to becoming a better decision maker. And being able to use risk more to your advantage than to your detriment.
Well, Kate, I want to thank you so much for coming on. And I really want to acknowledge you for doing the investigation into the brain. I mean, and it is the most powerful. It's the most powerful thing we have in our body. It's the thing that we really want everybody to be using. You've now written books about, you know, the brain and how it relates to sex, you know, the brain and now how it relates to risk. So for everybody out there, go out, get the book. Or if you want to just get a hold of Kate, you can go to, again, her website, which we just gave you. She has a blog on there, so you'll be able to communicate and talk about these very important subjects. So, Kate, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
All right. And thank you. And for everybody out there, please be sure to put us on your calendar to tune in next Monday, which is September 12th, when our guest, Elena Chatterley, and two of her former students from the Heritage Schools will join us to discuss residential treatment from a student's perspective. And we did this once before many years ago, and we had an incredible amount of feedback. So many parents were really interested in the fact of not only listening to us and or the therapist that was on there, but getting it directly from the students. In fact, I'll share a quote from a show many years ago. We had a parent that called in and asked about a particular issue. They said, you know, that they found drugs now a couple of times in their child's room, and their child says that it's their friends. And, do I believe him? Is there a matter of trust? And one of the young people that was at the time inside a residential treatment program said, ma'am, the first thing I need to tell you is we lie. and proceeded to explain their own situation and how many times they lied in that exact same situation. And so here we had a young person who was choosing to help the other young person by telling the truth about what they believed was really going on. So again, I recommend everybody to be with us. And again, if you've missed or you want to share this show or any other show, visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com. You may also subscribe or resubmit your name to download a free copy of the Attitude of Gratitude Journal, your 21-day guide to achieving the quality of thankfulness through self-discovery. And the next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page, check out some of the latest posts. If you like them, please like us, spread the word, be good human beings, and be with us again next week for Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.